I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FUNetworkTV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
The Broken Clock Podcast is back, and it's hot. Some people are dealing with a tropical storm or the aftermath of a tropical storm. In freaking July, we thought we'd lighten it up a bit this week and talk about fighting on the internet. Now, some of you may be saying, how is fighting on the internet a light topic? You are in for a treat, because Mouse and I have very different styles of fighting on the internet that sometimes overlap. But I think the thing we have in common, Mouse, is that neither of us take it terribly seriously. And when it stops being fun, we walk away. Is that accurate?
That is pretty accurate.
Yeah. I mean, you go for the throat online. It's funny because, like, I know you personally, and I can only imagine what someone thinks if the first they encounter you is savage mouse monster online. How do you determine the people you're going to take on online, and what's sort of the end goal?
Well, when I, the thing that really does, to use a not very accurate term, trigger kind of my, a certain level of reaction in me, usually comes from people whom I get a very, very beyond a reasonable doubt impression that they're arguing in bad faith. Okay. Here's the thing. I have had long and sometimes pretty tense conversations with people who disagree with me, people who think my philosophy is the furry Satan made manifest on Earth. But as long as it is done within a certain caliber, you know, you can have a tense conversation without having it turn into an argument.
Right. Right. Especially about serious things.
Right.
Yeah.
But then you have the people who clearly, okay, actually, because it's a light topic, I'm going to just start with a hit. Guys, take a hit back home, because I'm going to mention, She Who Must Not Be Named.
Especially lately, because of the Paycheck Protection Program.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's definitely an instance of them arguing on the internet. And we can touch upon that. But
yeah,
anyway.
I wouldn't mind touching upon that, because that's an example of just, it wasn't even worth starting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So Ayn Rand was at a talk show. This is in the late 80s, a couple of years before she died. This is after her husband Frank had died, and Frank was kind of her world. So she kind of crumbled for several years before she started coming out again. And this was an interview that happened, I think it was Phil Donahue, but I can't, I,
he that had white, sounds about right.
He had white hair, so I think it was Phil Donahue. And it was interesting because in the section for where, you know, he would go to audience members who had questions for the guest, he approached this woman who raised her hand, and she stood up and said, "Well, I used to be part of your cult when I was young." And Ayn Rand said, "Pass it over."
Right.
Of course, people got super angry. He said, why, you know, you're not letting her talk. And she said, "Well, there's a difference. See, this is my show right now, and I'm here to answer questions. She is not interested in actually asking a question in good faith. She is basically interested in just slinging mud at me. That is not a respectful opponent." And she then said to Phil Donahue, "I think you are a respectful opponent. We have disagreements. We have had this," because she came to the Phil Donahue show a couple of times. "We have had disagreements on this show many times, but it has never been anything of that sort. You ask me questions, you ask me difficult questions, I answer them back, and we have a back and forth, but it has never been, you belong to a cult, or you're a cult leader, or anything like that."
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell the tone from which a person is approaching an argument by caliber of words, by the general tone that they take up to you. For example, last week on our immigration, on our immigration podcast, there was one person who constantly said, well, when are you going to look at the immigration in Canada?
Which baffled me, to be clear, sorry to interrupt, which baffled me from the beginning, because that show wasn't about immigration in a particular country. It was the arguments underlying immigration policy. So it was applicable to any country.
Right.
Yeah.
So right from the start, so I looked at that overture. I also looked at some of the other posts I had made, and I went, aha. But that in that overture alone, I noticed several things. One, for example, is either the assumption that because you're discussing, you're touching upon the policies of one country, you're implying that another country's is better by comparison, even though you don't say it.
Well, actually, that wasn't even her claim. It was, I think we did say that on certain instances, like refugee systems, Canada was better. Mm-hmm. Better does not mean without flaw.
Right.
Right.
So in many cases, see, there's a different way that you can approach this. For example, I'll give you an example of how I would have reacted differently to their request. Would have said, I think this is a topic worth discussing. Would you guys consider taking a look at the Canadian system and, you know, critiquing it from your point of view? That is an entirely different approach. But because they took that very particular vein, I more or less knew that they weren't actually interested in the argument. They had a beef with someone involved in the podcast or the network or whatever, and they just wanted to start shit.
It wasn't even what I took from it. I think, well, their beef was with Ed the Sock. Mm. That was abundantly clear. And that particular person, and we should be clear that this, the fact that she was a white woman of British origin became extremely significant to the conversation as it went on.
Yes.
But she attacked my marital status as if that was relevant. But before she went on the attack, she completely ignored me to fight with you and another man in the discussion. And that just like, all right, lady, like if you're going to be that obviously transparent about your own intellectual and moral failings, let's go, because I haven't had a discussion of this kind in quite some time. And I found personally that the challenge for me was giving her enough benefit of doubt to allow her to continue to hang herself. Mm-hmm. Figuratively, obviously, not literally.
Right.
And the statement that she took incredible exception to was when I finally was like, you had trouble immigrating from the UK to a Commonwealth country, how bad do you have to screw that up? And of course, she's a Trudeau hater. There are a lot of those out there. I understand some reasons. She's not in law enforcement, though. I understand the law enforcement issues with Trudeau more than anything. But she also had a lot of really nasty stuff on her Twitter feed about Chrystia Freeland. And Chrystia Freeland, who is our deputy prime minister, she's our former, I believe, foreign minister. I saw her for the first time when she was at a debate, a proper formalized kind of Oxbridge rules debate, when she was just running for member of parliament. And what impressed me about Chrystia Freeland is how she could disagree, but it wasn't just disagree respectfully. She actually managed to disagree in a complimentary manner. And even though she was on the side of the debate that I didn't actually agree with, I was like, wow, you know, this is somebody who I immensely respect because she knows how to argue positively. And after that experience, it's like, okay, anybody who dislikes, like hates Chrystia Freeland, that says a lot more about them than it says about her, you know? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, the common thread with me and people like, not unfortunately, the common thread with people like Ayn Rand, Simone de Beauvoir, Betty Friedan, women like Chrystia Freeland, Bargis Chatter, a bunch of names where the Americans listening in Canadian politics, you're not going to know, is there is an undeniable veneer of sexism in how the public responds to them. And it's not just men. A lot of people think that sexism means, oh, men just can't handle a woman in power. A lot of women can't handle a woman in power or a woman with influence or a woman who defies traditional feminine gender norms, like Ayn Rand, like our former Premier Kathleen Wynne, who made some mistakes, but my God, that woman never actually had a chance, even though she was elected and then reelected. A very odd phenomenon. No one could stand her, but she got elected anyway. I mean, Kathleen Wynne was not only female, but she's also a lesbian. And that mattered. I don't care what you say. There were certain things that if a male politician did it, and people argue with me about this, and the problem with this sort of thing is it's very insidious, right? Like anybody who's been on the receiving end of this stuff, they know it. And you can be wrong, and you have to be very careful to eliminate other possibilities before you determine that this is the problem. But it was very, very similar to the treatment that Hillary Clinton got when she was running against Donald Trump. Nobody claims Hillary Clinton is an angel. Nobody claims she hasn't made some mistakes. Nobody claims that she hasn't done some things that one would claim to be corrupt. But holy crap, emails, you know? And this is an ongoing thing. Ironically, Trudeau gets it too. And there's some of that with this we charity thing that I know you're not up on, Mouse, but people are like, why aren't you talking about this if we don't talk about this? But people get an emotional response to something. They get a charge. And there is no shaking them from that. No. And this is a real issue with our political discourse. And that's why I found this particular woman who, she took exception to the fact that I wasn't nice to her. She has no idea, based on her behavior, how nice I was being.
Yes.
I wasn't genuflecting. And that was the issue. And she got very offended when I called her a Hyacinth Bouquet clone. For people who don't know, that's a character on Keeping Up Appearances. Who is a sort of a cartoon of the tendency of certain people in British middle class to put on airs and sort of act more important and more aristocratic than they are. And there was certainly a lot going on with this. Because the kicker to me is she clearly listened to the podcast. And she clearly listened to the fact that you have been toiling for over a decade in the immigration system. And she was comparing it to a 3-year wait because her and her friends wanted a very specific kind of visa that, you know, a skilled worker visa, which is often tied to specific offers of work.
Yes. And while I, you know, as anyone who listened to the podcast with anything other than the intent to find, to draw bias, would know, I myself think that weight in and of itself is also too much.
That's what killed me, is that the arguments we were making actually benefited her point of view. She clearly just, she didn't want fairness for everybody. She wanted special treatment for people like her.
That's ultimately what I took from that. And, you know, that sort of thing is what ultimately dictates the caliber of my reply. Because here's the thing. I do not believe you should demand of others that which you have never had the decency to give of yourself.
Well said.
And so, to expect civility when your arguments are apparently civil, but they have this underlying current.
Oh, she wasn't civil. She wasn't civil from the beginning. I tried. I did a few very neutral approaches to her to see if she was capable of coming down. And the only time she talked to any of us like human beings was when she found out that my stepfather was originally from Northern England. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I was in group, and that only made me angrier at her, because the hypocrisy of, for people who don't know how the geography and the class structure of England work, the North is more working class. It's looked down upon from the posher Londoners. You know, they're less cultured. They don't talk properly. They're low class, right?
Which is hilarious, because if I understand correctly, linguists have found that the accents in the North are actually closer to the accents and pronunciation that Shakespeare's English was at the period.
The classism of the United Kingdom is tied to nationalism. Mm-hmm. And yes, it is tied to the fact that the British royal family tended to marry foreigners, which affected the dialect. But it, like the classism that goes on in the UK is absurd.
Yeah.
And to be insisting front of the line status and then flying the Northern pride flag, I mean, the hypocrisy there was absurd. I told her as much, and it was like I violated some blood oath as far as she was concerned. And it was, it, I admit, that's the part that really disturbed me, that it wasn't about, it wasn't about an idea at that point. It wasn't about having an exchange of ideas. It was an attempt to dominate. Now, she was terrible at it, but it was an attempt to dominate, that white better than everybody else, though she'd never admit it. Her arguments were rooted in that conservative was better than liberal, that skilled immigration was more valid than refugees, or she took massive exception comparing the skilled labor program to acceptance of refugees. Mm-hmm. And the thing I noticed about her is that she, I think we all sort of understood she was very, very upset about something.
Yes.
I, for the life of me, don't quite know what she was upset about, because as we already dealt with, the things we were arguing actually would have benefited her circumstances. And that's what I find about arguing on the internet. Some people are terrible at expressing themselves, and they misidentify people's utter bewilderment at their inability to make a cogent point as bad faith, because bad faith is this buzzword on the internet, right? We're living in an era on the internet where the trolls have temporarily won. They have fostered an environment of distrust to the point where some people don't think it's possible to have a meaningful, enlightening conversation on the internet. Now, I can say for a fact that's not true. I've had many lovely discussions on the internet. I had a really interesting one earlier today where the guy was a massive Xbox fanboy. I'm very much not. We didn't agree, but it was a very pleasant conversation, and he ended up helping me with an Xbox Live account thing at the end. It's possible to have discussions, not agree on anything, and still learn something. People can't experience that online if they go in not believing that is possible. And the thing I got from this woman who went at you and then went at me when I didn't, you know, bend the knee to her because of something, some skill she kept referring to, but never explicitly identified what it was, as if a particular skill makes you more worthy as a human being than anyone else. I take issue with the entire logic behind that, but
it's the utilitarian view of people.
Yeah, it's funny. The utility monster concept has been coming up a lot lately, and maybe that's a way. Do you know the utility monster thought experiment?
No.
The utility monster is it was a thought experiment designed to show the flaws in utilitarian thinking. And what the utility monster basically is a fictional creature that utility is linked to pleasure, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost like a metastasized Randian point of view. That a monster that receives more utility from each unit of resources than humans do.
So more on the side of complete hedonism.
Right. And it doesn't, for the purposes of the thought experiment, it doesn't matter what the unit of resource is. Mm-hmm. It is the importance or the benefit gained from the unit of resource by this utility monster. And according to a utilitarian philosophy, it is therefore logical and indeed morally required to give all resources to this utility monster because that will be of the greatest raw benefit. And people are like, that's absurd, but that is why utilitarianism is absurd.
Right. That is the logical, a logical abstraction of the utilitarian process. And now I just can't, I have this mental image of a cookie monster-like creature now called the utility monster.
Me, utility, nom, 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 nom.
Yeah. Nom, nom, nom. Greatest number for the greatest good. Ah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, I think because some people have trouble with abstraction, they don't understand that, yes, this is an absurdist argument showing the problems with certain philosophies. Mm-hmm. And any philosophy taken to its absurdist extreme is going to look terrible. However, some philosophical systems look absurd with far less effort than others.
Yes.
You know? And that's what you see a lot on the internet. Like, I see a lot of people on the internet boxed into these thought processes or these identities. And they don't really know why. They kind of ended up there by process of elimination. But suddenly it's very important to them because this identity has given them people to sort of organically associate with, that has provided them with a level of perceived protection on the internet. And so anything that potentially shakes that identity creates mm-hmm. a massive backfire effect.
Right.
And that's where, especially as political discourse moves increasingly online, that's the part that really worries me. And that's why, as light as this topic kind of is, I think it's very important to discuss. Because at the core of this woman's attacks against all of us was the presumption of us as liberals, which is funny because you don't actually identify as a liberal.
No,
I just assumed. Yeah, she just assumed.
You could say, yeah, like, for example, you could say that I have some stances that are liberal adjacent, but in and of itself, I do not subscribe. I do not identify myself as a liberal. I have some disagreements with some elements of the platform as it is in the United States, etc. So I'm in one of those situations where liberals consider me a conservative, and conservatives consider me a liberal.
Yeah, because I think where our sort of points of view intersect is we're both sort of on the liberal side of libertarianism, mm-hmm. in that if you actually take the ideas of maximum liberty for the maximum number of people, certain progressive philosophies are more in line with that than conservative ideologies that want to control what people do in their bedrooms, and in some cases, even in their own heads, mm-hmm. on questions of identity. And I mean, this spills out into the internet because every philosophical ideology, every political stripe has some wing that is attempting to chill and control speech on the internet. And mm-hmm. it's getting a little bit disturbing because increasingly the various platforms are just panicking and they're falling more and more and more into sort of just shut it all down so we don't have to fight with it anymore, if that makes any sense.
Right. And, you know, as someone who has seen how social media, things like Facebook have evolved, I have at times thought, you know, maybe this should just be all shut down because it's a pile of poo. But
I think we all have those moments.
We all have had those moments. It's like, this is all shit. Let it all flush out.
Yeah. It's, I admit the, when who was it? Ted Cruz and Rand Paul jumped over to Parler, the right wing thing. I think it's so odd that a right wing English language service would adopt a
Parler
word for talk as their name. Bastardize the pronunciation because of course. It's the French word for talk. Like, that is what is so weird. But the
voulez-vous parler avec moi?
Yeah, exactly. but the fact that they were cheering the fact that liberals were getting kicked off the platform for griefing conservatives because Parler believes in free speech. It just broke my brain how anybody could say that with a straight face.
And especially with the complaints, especially with the nature of the complaints that made them move to Parler in the first place.
Yeah, I find it strange that politicians of all people would deliberately enter echo chambers. It really shows that politicians Ted Cruz, is anybody surprised? I mean, Ted Cruz's loathsomeness is a punchline in Washington right now.
I mean, the whole joke that he was actually the Zodiac killer just kind of really, the fact that you could stop for a moment and go, you know, that could be true.
it's only funny because it's not. But
yeah, exactly.
Ted Cruz clearly gets elected, reelected, and reelected because Texas is a profoundly low turnout state. So you get a consolidation of a fairly small minority and you keep getting a mandate. But mm-hmm. Rand Paul, Kentucky's vulnerable. And not only is he showing that he is not a true libertarian with
this. Oh, he's done that a long time ago.
Yeah, but some people still, he's sort of still basking in the reflected glow of his father, who I don't think was much of a libertarian either, but he's
not
better
really
than Rand is. But I think it's a bad tactical move. Because Kentucky is one of those states that's very quietly shifting purple because of healthcare. And at some point, America is going to have to do something about its healthcare system because no one agrees that it's working terribly functionally. However, if you have removed yourself from the more public debate, where you not only could possibly persuade a person or two, but you can also see what the arguments counter to your position are, I think that puts you in a very weak place in a state like Kentucky, where, you know, it's been walloped by the opioid epidemic. I mm-hmm. think part of the popularity of Trump in that state, oh God, I'm going to say Trump did something functionally correct. is that he promised, he swore up and down, he'd do something about the opioid epidemic.
And I mean, that, it happens sometimes.
But that was like the one thing I thought I could actually trust Trump to do effectively because of his very staunch, very personal, emotional anti-drug stance. And he didn't. He got so distracted by this identity politics garbage that he never effectively addressed the opioid epidemic. And people are still suffering accordingly. I mean, the double whammy of COVID and an opioid addiction, oh my God, I don't know what that does to your body.
Oh, gosh.
But it's very strange that so-called lovers of liberty would step away from a free speech, from a platform, because they don't like mean things people are saying.
Yes. As I said, an actual libertarian remembers the quote that Voltaire said, you know, I may not like what you're saying, but I will defend your right to say it to the death, even if it's mean things said about me, as long as it's, you know, legally enforced libel or slander, you know. But
I mean, there's an interesting debate about that going on up here, because what it means to be a journalist in Canada, there's a discrepancy between what the courts say and what the sort of average person, the average person believes that journalism has certain standards.
Right.
Now, in the era of things like Fox News, Breitbart, and up here a service called the Post-Millennial, which, full disclosure, did a really nasty hatchet job on my husband. Now, does that mean that everything the Post-Millennial prints is untrue? No. Does it mean that very often they print things that lack journalistic rigor and are therefore defamatory? Yes, I will say the same thing about services like the Huffington Post. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of the reason, despite my annoyance with some of their filtering, that I keep going back to established mainstream news services like NBC News is they at least have some standards.
Right. Is the... quick question, because I haven't kept up with them since I graduated. Is the Christian Science Monitor still considered fairly even keel?
You know what? I don't know, because they have opposed Trump in places. And
they have what? Sorry?
They have opposed Trump in places. I mean, okay, I would say that the Christian Science Monitor is an example of a publication with a declared bias.
Right. Now, the interesting thing is when I was doing my undergrad, mm-hmm. And it was at a liberal arts school, very, very underline liberal.
Yeah.
It was pretty much a hippie college.
Right.
Which, of course, some people would be surprised. I can reassure you, I did not fit in as well as you would imagine. I was taking, at that point, I was taking journalistic research classes, because mm-hmm. why not, right? Mm-hmm. And at the time, they did in the class, this Christian Science Monitor was listed as one of the more tone-neutral, more objective publications.
It still seems under the umbrella of Christianity. Mm-hmm. It seems decent in that regard. I mean, the one I rely on is the Economist.
The Economist.
That tends to be, and part of the reason I enjoy it is it is to the right of me. And I think that's important.
Right. It serves as a check.
It serves as a check, but you know what? It serves as a check that I respect. Mm-hmm. My tendency, because I am a very abstract thinker, is to be like, whatever, let people do whatever they want. I don't really care. It doesn't really affect me. And I need to sort of be brought back into the realm of reality and people that some of these things that I don't think are big deals does affect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, economic consequences are one of those instances where it's like, yeah, okay, too much, too fast, bad for business. Right. It's one of the things I had to recognize my blind spot regarding the US healthcare system. You know, one of the things, like up here in Canada, since we have a single payer, it's not true socialized medicine. Hospitals are private businesses. That's something a lot of people get wrong. But we do not understand. America has a totally different structure of government than Canada does. It would be much more difficult to create a federally mandated, provincially or state regulated healthcare system under the American framework than it is up here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people's eyes glaze over and they say, I just don't care. And it's like, that's fine. As a layperson, you don't have to care. But if you actually want to get into a policy debate and figure out how to get this done, you have to care, because otherwise things will be rightly challenged by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in the US is delightfully unpredictable now. I don't know yes. about you. I am loving the surprises.
It's yes, it's definitely it certainly hasn't turned out the way a lot of people thought they would.
Yeah, and even the rulings that personally upset me, I actually think are right. Notably the birth control ruling regarding the nuns.
Yes.
It's such an inherently strange lawsuit just on symbolism, though, as an aside, Warrior Nun on Netflix is surprisingly excellent. But these aren't warrior nuns. These are nuns. And I'm like, why?
How do you know?
Well,
how do you know?
Well, why do nuns need birth control? Right? And then it's right. like, all right, no, there are additional employees of this. I just think that if you're going to work for a staunchly Catholic organization where there are literal nuns, that's yeah. different than working at a Chick-fil-A or a Hobby Lobby.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, as you know, I'm not a religious person by yeah. any stretch of the imagination, but you also know, you know, my stance also does happen to be, you know, I do believe that the separation of church and state should be a thing.
Oh, I agree too.
And one of my frustrations is that it does not get observed enough in the United States. Often it gets observed in favor of establishing religious policies. But in this case, for example, I do believe the ruling was appropriate.
Yeah, even though I personally don't like it.
Right.
It's the same thing as the wedding cake case. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't understand why in cases like this, people don't see these as business opportunities. If there is an area that needs, say, a bakery that is LGBTQ plus friendly, there's a business opportunity, right?
Oh, hell yeah.
You don't get anywhere by forcing people to talk the talk. You actually have to change hearts and minds, and nobody likes to be forced to do something. Now, there are instances where you kind of have to, you know, and this is where we get into the thorny debate around hate speech mm-hmm. on the internet. And I don't think we've ever actually talked about this, Mouse. I'm torn. I admit this is something where I feel like I'm just a sailboat in a hurricane. On the one hand, I do think that these social media platforms are too broad in how they define hate speech. I also, however, think that hate speech rules are probably a good thing. And that if you live in a place with very strict hate speech rules, laws, and you violate them, you have to be prepared to accept the punishment that comes with breaking the law if you're going to be a conscientious objector to the law. And I know that was kind of messy, but what do you think about it?
See, I have a different approach towards hate speech rules. Now, are we talking about government level, or are we talking about private
companies? Well, that's the thing, right? Like, private companies, quite frankly, can set whatever terms they want, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's an important thing. Companies
Definitely.
can create, I mean, if it's not a toxic work environment, of course, that's a problem. But yeah. companies can set any rules for conduct they choose, provided they don't violate human rights. Right. That is different from protection from the government. That is different from you know, a that is different from defamation. I personally think that a lot of hate speech is actually just defamation and is therefore not protected. But, you know, like, for instance, I took a lot of flack for, remember the guy who taught his dog to do the Nazi salute?
Oh God, that was what, 10 years ago?
It was not 10 years ago, but it feels like it was 10 years ago. Because somebody demanded, I was doing a podcast this week on The Last of Us 2, and somebody demanded to know if I changed my views on that case. And I'm like, no, because my views were the idea that he was going to go to jail for this when the standard punishment is a fine is absurd. I thought it was overblown. But I do think that someone who teaches their dog to do a Nazi salute to piss off their girlfriend because they think that's funny has some anti-Semitism going on there.
Well, most likely.
Yeah, that is what a person was horribly offended that I said. And what I said to them was like, look, I really believe in free speech, and YouTube has the right, because it was taken off of YouTube, and then he got dragged into court, and of course he got a fine. And instead of just paying the fine because he's got one of these alt-right lawyers, we're going to fight this. Like, oh, come on. It's a parking ticket, guys. But YouTube took the video down. I'm good with that, you know, because of the way algorithms work. It's not funny. I understand why it's offensive to people. It's dumb. That poor freaking animal. I love pugs. I feel bad for this dog. But this idea that he should be pulled into court. Well, jailed, no, ridiculous. Nobody should be put in jail for a stupid, poor taste joke.
Yeah.
But fined? I don't agree with that law. But again, if that's where you live, you have to be prepared to accept that law. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Or be, you know, or be prepared for all the vicissitudes that will come with contesting that law, if that is your intention.
I mean, yeah.
It wasn't his intention.
No, I respect Howard Stern greatly. He violates the FCC. He pays the FCC fines. He fights them when he thinks they're unfair. But when it's ruled against him, he pays the damn fines. I respect the hell out of that. That's the standard I follow. But people say to me, that's anti-free speech. It's like, why is that anti-free speech? That to me is the height of putting your money where your mouth is and standing up for your principles. You believe in those principles so strongly that you are prepared to pay the consequences for civil disobedience.
Pretty much. Having, you know, civil disobedience does not suddenly make it so that the very thing that you're opposing is not going to be visited upon you. I mean, if it is unfair, you keep fighting, you keep bringing attention to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the unfortunate things is that very often we live in a world in which you have a great deal of injustices being perpetrated upon you. And when you protest it, you often do get bitten.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, the whole point of activism is that you educate people on why something is wrong, not merely scream that it is wrong.
Yeah,
because you know, we live in a world more so than ever, we're both connected and also isolated. Although I do disagree that we're more disconnected than ever, because, you know, when we were the most disconnected, you might say, oh, the Middle Ages.
No kidding.
We were very, very disconnected. And what people want to say when they say that we're disconnected is that we are not as, say, personal interaction oriented as we may have been in the past,
I think there's been a breakdown in local neighborhood cohesion. Now, the reasons for that are a question for another time. But I think that's what people mean when they say we're more disconnected than we've ever been.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, people move a lot more than they did before. That's one of the things that affects it, and so on and so forth. So, but where was I? I got lost in the woods.
Oh, you were saying that the interconnectedness.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. But so we also have to realize that many of the people that we would like to guide are living in an experience where what you're experiencing or what you're seeing might be completely alien to them. The whole point of being an activist is taking this perspective
yes.
that someone may not be familiar with and say, and you know, tell them this is what's going on. This is real. This is actually happening. Of course,
right.
At which point you will get people interested in learning more. And then there's people who will dismiss you.
Right.
Which is very, very common right now in the United States. The people who will dismiss you might eventually come to your side. Eventually, after the burden of proof has smacked them over the head.
I can personally attest to this.
But in and of itself, once they dismiss you and once they abandon reason, they're not really your primary target anymore.
No, you can only persuade the persuadable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which ties to why I respond to people online the way I do sometimes, because when I detect that someone is not there to actually have a dialogue, but to dismiss me, then I go, okay, I have no reason, I have no obligation to you to explain myself. All I can do is ridicule your points because they are ridiculous, and underline all of the insidious arguments you're making, and that's it. Because you're not here, you're not interested in learning. You just want to put me down and show your superiority.
That's it. It's the way I've seen some people talk, and I think it's learned behavior, so they don't realize the mechanics of the tactic. Mm-hmm. But there is a way of speaking that the fulcrum of it is to display superiority.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've seen people come at you that way. And right before you unleash a barrage of Shakespearean level tongue lashing, I have enough time to think, oh, you poor deluded fools. And it's really, I don't understand why people approach things that way.
I think it's an identity thing.
It is. It's that we are no longer a culture of ideas. We are a culture of siloed identities.
Mm-hmm. It's and kind of a totemic approach to an idea.
It is very much like the 1960s and the 1970s and what happened to Black women during that era, that there were two competing civil rights movements, the second wave feminist movement and then the Black civil rights movement. And Black women were caught in between the two because mm-hmm. White feminists were in charge of the second wave. They didn't understand that the primary issues for Black women were not the same as the primary issues for white women because of things like redlining and Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. And they were ostracized for that, even though they saw gendered inequalities within their own community, but they were also kind of shamed for being race traitors among the Black community. So a lot of Black women chose the civil rights movement instead of the second wave feminism movement, and therefore weren't at the table, weren't getting their concerns heard, and were left behind as a result. And I'm very concerned that certain, especially people from South and Central America, or people who may have come from former Soviet bloc countries, who believe very much in progressive rights, progressive ideas, because they came from such regressive places, mm-hmm. but do not believe that progressive ideals are achieved through socialist and or Marxist political, cultural, and financial ideology. They're getting just totally sidelined. They have no people.
Yeah, I have experienced something along those lines. As you know, I came from South America, a country that became populist and then 21st century socialist, mm-hmm. which was just kind of like Hugo Chavez's system, but just prettied up for the press kind of thing. And so I have many, many times said, you know, I do not support the alt-right. I do not support nationalism. I do not support. And one of the things that I always get is that, well, I get that people say, well, you can't be anti-alt-right and be pro-capitalism. You can't be in favor of human rights and be pro-capitalism.
Why the alt-right's not pro-capitalism?
Well, that's the problem. See, very few people know what capitalism actually is anymore, because we have had crony capitalism for forever.
Yeah, the alt-right really likes nepotism.
Yeah.
It does not like capitalism.
Because capitalism means that you can actually be, you know, out-competed by a much more competent person, which is the total opposite of nepotism, which is where you secure position and employment through family liaisons,
and
not by.
That's why they want to keep everybody else out. You know, they don't want fair competition. Just, I do not understand how the alt, that's why it's the alt-right. It's not the establishment right or the traditional right. It's the alternative right, because they're not for, like, my mind's blown on that you've actually gotten that argument. I've never encountered that personally, and I think I'm glad I haven't.
Well, it often does tend to be on the side of the furries are, there's an enormously large gaggle of furries that have bought into the Marxist thing, which
is it, is that the official taxonomy, a gaggle of furries?
A gaggle, well,
because I'd imagine that's a real semiotics problem. Like, what do you call a group of furries, seeing as different types of furs call themselves different things?
I guess you could have a parade of furries because of the fursuit parades, maybe.
I don't know. You may be accused of goose supremacy. Yeah. There, you are arguing that is good for the goose is good for the
good wolf.
Of course, I'm kidding. I had that. Remember, I said I abstract.
You yes.
said that. It's like, is that what you call it? I mean, I want to be furry friendly. Is that, for people who don't know, a furry culture is basically anthropomorphized animals. Go on. What were you saying?
I broke down
a gaggle of furries. I'm like, oh, that's gonna possibly be the most contentious thing you've ever said. so much for a light topic. No, I'm kidding. You said that there tends to be gaggles in furries that lean Marxist.
Yes, there's a very large gaggles of that tend towards the more Marxist ideologies. Yeah. And many, unsurprisingly, many of them happen to be popular furry artists.
Really? Okay, interesting.
Yeah. It's actually very interesting, because the popular furry artists will openly talk about Marxism, but then you wouldn't notice, you wouldn't be able to tell by looking at their commission prices.
Right. That's why I was like, wow, people who get by on commissions are overtly Marxist. Okay. Sure.
Well, their notion is that, you know, if you have a Marxist system, then they would be treated as the artist class, which doesn't really exist in a Marxist system, because it's more about utility. Marxism is this very, very strange marriage of utilitarianism at its very core, because it's what is most useful for the collective, and if the collective rules that, you know, art is a luxury and we don't really need luxuries around here, so off to work at the mill. For the greater good.
What you end up being is in the Ministry of Propaganda, if history is served. And then you
create some very, very, very gay posters.
Well, and yeah, but also that's because overt deviancy tends to be crushed in,
in conformist collectivist societies.
Yeah.
That's another thing they're not counting on.
This is where I start going, I know they're well-meaning. I know they truly believe what they say. These seem like ideas born out of desperation. But if you drill down at all, Houston and every other major city on the planet, we have problems.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, but if- this is why abstraction is so important. This is why thought experiments like the utility monster are so important, because people go to places like this and then they start advocating for things like this and they don't realize that they're actually advocating against their own best interests.
Right. And, you know, I don't know if I showed you the conversation where that happened, where I was told, well, you can support Black Lives Matter. You can support, you can't support individual rights, and you can't oppose the alt-right while being a capitalist.
What?
I think I showed you that. It came from a furry. That conversation where I basically went, okay, well, I did not, because I knew that this was not a person, because I always tend to look at the people's feeds before I engage when they confront me, because I want to see, you know, are they actually arguing in good faith? Are they arguing in bad faith? Is this their style? Are they confrontational, but, you know, well-meaning,
right.
or are they trolls? And I saw that this person was overall well-meaning, a bit on the brash and blunt side, but not on the same level as certain people we have discussed before.
Still good faith.
Still good faith.
Right.
Possibly
reachable if you can change their frame.
Right.
Yeah.
Good faith, potentially abrasive, but then again, I'm not put off by abrasiveness when
that seems like a fairly simple reframing, because are we talking about Black Lives Matter, the hashtag, like Black Lives Matter, the idea, or are we talking about Black Lives Matter, the various independently run organizations across the US, Canada, and parts of Europe? Like, those are three different things.
Right. And it's kind of like when they say, well, Antifa is socialist. Yeah, you can have loose organizations of people who support Antifa, who are maybe on the Marxist spectrum, but you can completely be just to be opposed to fascism and be a capitalist. In fact, capitalists, real capitalists, would be opposed against fascists, fascism.
Right.
Because fascism makes capitalism impossible. It replaces it with cronyism.
Right.
In which case, it is not a fair competition arena, but the government picking winners and losers.
Right.
So I approached this person and I went, okay, I hear what you're saying, but why?
Yeah.
Why is it that I can only be this and not that?
Did they have an answer?
They blocked me.
Really?
They blocked me because I did not jump the gun at that moment. And I get the impression that this person has encountered people on the alt-right spectrum who claim to be capitalists, because there's quite a few of those, bizarrely enough, even though, you know, the alt-right and capitalism are categorically opposed to each other.
Well, the alt-right is very good at co-opting things people like and turning them into things that people feel like they must renounce so that they don't get lumped in. You know, poor Pepe the Frog is an example of that, right?
That poor guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a guy had his creation destroyed via appropriation, and people who claim that they oppose cultural appropriation just let it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awful. I feel awful that the guy had his creation taken from him.
As an artist, that just pisses me off.
But. Oh, it's awful. It's to me, that is ideological fascism at work effectively in the modern era.
Yeah.
Like, that's not fair.
Yeah, it is not. But here's the thing. I got the impression that this person had, in all of the times that they had engaged on Twitter in this manner, that they had never actually encountered someone who went, okay, can you tell me why?
See, I think people like that, they hit a point where they actually don't know and they panic.
Well, because they've been engaged for so long in things like fight and flight response, and, you know, angry Twitter wars. And here's the thing. This is something I have come to realize. If someone has been exposed to that for so long, if that has been their ecosystem that long, when they encounter someone who might actually approach them in good faith and ask them why, they will be suspicious. And they
I've encountered a lot of that, yeah.
they will be suspicious and think, what type of manipulation is this person gearing me up for? Is it even worth the effort? No, I'll just block them.
That's a good observation. I think also people are so overloaded now that they don't want to have to think. They just want the right answer that's going to keep them out of trouble. Just tell me what to say. I don't care.
Yeah.
And that is one of my very grave concerns about the way discourse is done online. It is very propagandistic, and people are afraid of nuance. And nuance is extremely important.
Because the devil is in the details.
Yeah, but...
And more.
But if you want to outrun the devil... You got to pay attention to the details because, you know, it's all about the fine print with that stuff. And I don't know. I'm very, very concerned about the impact on discourse that people think nuance is some sort of trap.
Yeah.
And I'm not, I mean, the textbook, way of dealing with that sort of thing is that you reframe the debate in something that corresponds to the person you're trying to persuade's core ideals. The problem is that a lot of people don't have core ideals. Everything is identity.
Yes. And on that particular subject, there is a book by Take a Shot.
Okay.
Ayn Rand.
Okay.
It's called Philosophy, Who Needs It? And it's one of my favorite books, even if you just read the first chapter. Ayn Rand does a thought experiment that tries to demonstrate why philosophy, even though, you know, many people consider it just wool gathering, fluffy, nothing related to reality sort of thing, why it is actually the most important thing. And she goes on to make the argument, you know, imagine that you are an astronaut who is trapped in a foreign planet. Your instruments have gone completely berserk. You can't be certain of anything. You've told yourself, well, you know, I can't know anything. I don't know how to find, I don't know where I am. I don't know how far away I am from Earth. And you kind of abandon yourself to your fate, and then you see some shapes lumbering in the distance, and you go, well, they will know what to do. And so you go towards them, and then you're never heard from again. Mm-hmm. And Ayn Rand draws the idea of this astronaut as the modern man, who, via movements such as postmodernism, has grown to believe that things like certain levels of certainty are impossible. You know, it is impossible to know anything for sure. You have to doubt your senses, you have to doubt your judgment all the time, etc. And so you don't have a tool set because, you know, that means all of the old philosophies are wrong. And they are wrong to a certain extent, but they're also right to a certain extent in varying degrees.
Right.
But postmodernism essentially sweeps away all standards so that there is really no standard.
Right.
And so what it does to the modern man and woman and everyone else in between is that you're left sort of adrift in the cultural morass so that you don't have an integrative, abstracted, philosophical core principle, but rather you start absorbing values from the culture by osmosis, which means that at the end of the day, you become a gigantic mess of self-contradictions.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, I say all the time that Rand was very influenced by Jewish thought. And two of the seven rules of Hillel kind of apply to this idea of, you know, well, if all these opposing things are true, then nothing is true, right? Sort of the postmodern dilemma. And I think these things are kind of useful when talking on the internet, because they seem like very simple concepts, but they informed Rand's thought a lot, but other people, I think they should they should take this into account when dealing things like I think this is why people get so upset and frightened when, say, trans advocacy comes into it, because you're really shaking up people's fundamentals when you're questioning things like binary gender, right? Mm-hmm. That takes a bit for people to get their heads around the entire concept behind it. So it's the fifth rule, usually called the general in particular. A general principle may be restricted by a particularization of it. Conversely, a particular rule may be extended into a general principle. That's one thing that's super important. The other is, two things may seem to conflict until compared with a third. And that one, I think, is very interesting. Because so much of this complexity gets confused with pointlessness, because people don't know how to, first of all, be okay with abstractions, but also how to effectively navigate abstractions. And so they want systems that will just tell them what to do. And
has never turned out well, has it?
Well, you know, it's turned out really well for the iPhone. Hear me out here, okay? The entire philosophy behind Apple's products is that these are for people who just want to learn certain rules of how devices operate. They don't want a ton of customization. They don't want a ton of freedom. They're fine with closed financial ecosystems. They just want it to be easy to use. And we see this with Facebook. We see this with YouTube. We see this with so many things that people are giving away their privacy, their freedom of purchasing, you know, where they can buy certain devices and accessories for those devices just for ease of use. Mm-hmm. And as much as we may all want to say, oh, they're just Philistines or something, you know, similarly pompous, it does come down to the truth that for most people, their day-to-day lives are overwhelmingly complicated. And I don't know if people are looking for certainty or people are just looking for a little bit of simplicity. And I can really understand that. I get that. I see that point of view, which is part of the reason that, you know, I like to do podcasts like this, because we use like pop culture references and silly things like a gaggle of furries to sort of make really verbose, wordy, you know, kind of navel gazing concepts more accessible and digestible for people. And yeah, sometimes we get a bit reductive. Sometimes we get a bit generalizy. Sometimes we oversimplify.
We get punch happy.
Yeah, sometimes we sing, you know. But, you know, I think for most people, they're not going to go read Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason.
Please don't. Spare yourselves. Run.
They're not going to read The Will as worded representation. Things like that, you know. And they, you know what? They shouldn't have to. There should be more relevant to this millennia sources. One of the books I love, and this sounds crazy, but The Tao of Willie Nelson. It's short, it's small. He talks about Heine Hurt and hot sauce, and because he loves hot sauce. But and a lot of people would consider it politically incorrect by today's standards. But you know what? It really brings Taoism down to its fundamentals. And I think that because we interact with a lot of things, especially politics, that try to pull people away from fundamentals, because that makes it you know, easier to sort of persuade people to vote against their own best interests, so that, you know, you can persuade people to adopt your ideals instead of changing your platform to better suit your constituents. because then you do that, you're going to piss off somebody else. But I do sort of think that there are certain fundamental ethical principles that still have weight, right? That, yeah. that aren't whisked away by, you know, progressive ideology and our, you know, our modernity. And people start going, well, what are those? You know? And to me, I think that, and this is part of the reason I've clashed so much with the game The Last of Us 2, for people who have played the game and like it and have followed my stuff. The value of the individual, the fact that every existence, every life has meaning and has inherent value, is essential to ethics, no matter what you believe, you know? And this idea that it is the wrong choice to save a life because, you know, that would you go back and kill Hitler thing. As long as there is life, there is possibility. Yes, if you go snuff out a life, you may end the bad possibilities, but you also end any potential good ones as well, you know?
Right.
You know, oh, there's
that whole time travel argument is just
it's a thought experiment, but I mean, it's interesting going back to Hillel. He had a series of maxims, mm-hmm. that one of them was, most people just hear the end of it. The whoever saves a life, it is though he has saved the entire world. But that's mm-hmm. not the complete quote. The complete maxim was, whosoever destroys one's soul, it is as though he had destroyed the entire world. And whosoever saves a life, it is as though he had saved the entire world. But that destruction of the soul gets left out a lot.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, he was also the guy who came up with, what is hateful to you, do not do unto your fellow. Mm-hmm. That's it. The rest is explanation. But the interesting quote that I think is very Randian, and I think where Rand got a lot of her ideas, is, you don't hear this one very much, but it is really central. Now, remember, this is a guy who was around in 110 BC. Okay, that's when he was born. We're going way back.
Way back.
Way back. And what he said was, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? And being for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? And to me, that's the maxim for fighting on the internet. If I am not for myself, who will be for me?
Yes.
You know? And being for myself, what am I? And the last part, it's like, if not now, when? Like, a lot of people wait to be themselves. A lot of people wait until it's safe to be themselves, you know? Mm-hmm. Because they're afraid of the mob. They're afraid of the crowd. And the truth is, you know, a lot of these people who are like, well, you can't do this unless you're doing this. Well, who told you that? You know, why are you limiting your own options? Why are you making it an either or instead of a yes and?
Exactly.
Yeah. And those are people who are not for themselves. Therefore, no one else is for them either. And this is why they have to hide in these false collectives on the internet. And the reason I say false collectives is you see it in every single one of them. The minute their external enemy is not in the picture anymore, they start imploding. Yeah.
Yep.
They start fighting over nonsense. You know, a lot of those, you know, really awful subreddits were deleted by Reddit. And almost immediately, groups that existed allegedly just to oppose those subreddits started fighting about dumb crap. Because all they were was opposition to something. That's actually my issue with the Antifa movement, for quite frankly. That, okay, you oppose fascism, but what are you for?
Exactly. And well, in many ways, it does have the same problem as the Libertarian Party, because if the Libertarian Party has a problem that they have freedom as the axiom, but they don't, you know, they don't have a philosophical backbone that explains where freedom comes from and why, and you know, that freedom as a corollary of, you also have, you know, the opposition to fascism as an axiom. Okay, but what do you oppose it with? Well, that, you know, if you don't answer that question, then of course you open the door for the Marxists, etc., and, you know, all these other movements that are in and of themselves potentially just as bad as fascism.
Well, I don't quite understand how it's anti-fascist to go beat up people who are at a rally you don't like.
Right.
That's the big issue I have with that movement. Like, that seems like a pretty fascist. And obviously, I'm not saying all people who self-identify as Antifa do that. Some people are just, you know, online keyboard warriors. They don't go out and commit violence. It's that wing of it. You know, how is beating someone up because you don't like what they're saying anti-fascist? And I've never gotten an appropriate answer for that other than, well, that's what they did in the 1930s. You know, in places like 1930s. What's that?
Yeah, except most of those people weren't alive in the 1930s.
Well, and the other problem is that much like, you know, Nixon used rioting to get reelected under totalitarian terms, much like, I hate to Godwin, but the very anti-fascist movement that people lionize now is the one that Hitler gamed to seize more power. And that's
right,
what they were doing was wrong, right? It just, you gotta argue smart as well as hard.
Right. The problem is that when you move from an emotional perspective, you don't have arguments, you have emotion. And a fist is one of the most emotional responses out there, but a fist is not an argument.
And that doesn't mean that sometimes it's not warranted.
Right.
And I know, like, this is what I mean about nuance. This is what I mean about complexity. Like, a lot of people have trouble understanding why people were more sympathetic to the Black Lives Matter protesters than the anti-maskers or the quarantine defiers. Because again, they have issues with the abstraction of you know, higher level principles, mm-hmm. First order principles. And, you know, it's a difficult thing to explain to someone other than, well, first of all, the Black Lives Matter protesters were all wearing masks, so they were taking it seriously.
Yeah.
There does not seem to have been outbreaks surrounding those gatherings, like the George mm-hmm. Floyd Memorial,
right.
Which is very interesting to me, because I wasn't sure how that was going to go. But
yeah.
Also, I mean, you're talking about a group of people who are comparing, I can't go out to a bar and...
I can't get my pedicure.
Yeah, and I might get someone very, very ill, and I might get ill... I might also get shot in my own bed by police.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I mean about something may not make sense until you compare it to a third thing. Remember mm-hmm. that principle I talked about?
Oh, yeah.
It may seem in opposition until you compare it to a third thing. That's how it works in practice.
There you go, all boys and girls.
All of a sudden, yeah, all of a sudden, the two things are not in conflict. There is a third variable that makes everything clearer.
Because, and here's, this is something that Rand said, which is something I do like, there is no such, in nature, there is no such thing as a contradiction. If you have arrived at a contradiction, you need to re-examine your premises because along the way, you have made the wrong assumption.
Did she actually say that?
Yep.
Oh man, I want that on a shirt or I want that as a poster. So that's beautiful.
It's she says it in her writing, in her nonfiction, but she also has Hugh Axton, the philosophers say that to Dagny Taggart at the diner, the roadside diner that he runs. I don't remember which chapter that's in, but if anyone wants to look that up, it's when Dagny runs into Hugh Axton at his roadside diner cooking
hamburgers. That just crystallizes for me the reason why I get so upset whenever anybody dismisses intersex people as birth defects.
Mm-hmm.
Because those, you know, intersex people are alleged contradictions by our framing, But if you apply there is no such thing in nature as a contradiction. It just means, well, this makes sense somehow. We got to figure this out.
Right, because you can't have a contradiction in nature. Otherwise, basically, the metaphysical nature of the universe would not hold up.
Now, I believe some people think it actually is just a big Truman Show, but that is what arguing on the internet is for. Okay, I think we have come to no conclusions, but it's been an excellent journey, including me being introduced to the term a gaggle of furries. I'm going to sit with that one because there is no such thing in nature as a contradiction. So a gaggle of furries is not a contradiction. I'll figure this out. All right. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast on the FU Network. Support us on Patreon, on PayPal. Get some merchandise. You can find it all through our website, which is going through some changes right now. Bear with us as we sort of rebuild. There's some back-end stuff going on that breaks some of the front-end stuff from time to time, but it is still functional. FUnetwork.tv. Remember, thinking is good for you, even if it hurts sometimes and involves a gaggle of furries.
Furries.
You have the last fuzzy word.
I don't dare say more, or the furries will come after me.
This is fun! The FU Network.